attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we tried to bluff a couple of cold-eyed card sharps with a three of clubs, a Pokemon shiny, and an Uno reverse e-card, all to win the attention of poker enthusiast and serial entrepreneur, Joe Living. The founder of Aces High, a company specializing in poker for business workshops, Joe uses her considerable cards, communication, and commercial skills to teach businesses about everything from negotiation and assertiveness to risk management and empathy. Joe's philosophy is wildly different from all those macho poker stereotypes, focusing more on the strategic interactions and human observations than two cowboys flipping over a table and throwing each other through a saloon window. As well as Aces High, Joe's extensive entrepreneurial energies are plugged into a number of diverse ventures, from a mindfulness program to a job site to a personal development program for women in leadership. Which, of course, doesn't mean that she's too busy to beat you out of your money, your car keys, your children's future car keys, and a couple of less important organs. Joe says it's a microcosm of how people show up in the boardroom. Poker is a contact sport. You are eye to eye with your opponents. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you so much. That's a pleasure to be here.
Right, Joe, seven quick fires I warned you about. Stick or twist?
Twist.
Boardroom table or poker table?
I'm gonna have to say poker table.
Very good. Right, best song now, Poker Face or Ace of Spades?
Poker Face.
Nice. Myers-Briggs or Traitors?
Oh, did you have to? I do love Traitors. Yeah, Traitors.
Okay. So for context, Aces High has been described as a blend of the two. Two more, ridiculously, the power of love or the power of the pause?
The power of the pause.
And lastly, and I hope we'll get to talk about this, betting on England to win the World Cup or not betting on England to win the World Cup?
There's a backstory with this, which we'll get to, but I think not betting on England to win the World Cup.
Wise words. Amazing. Listen, Joe, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So we always start the show, and I know this is like the resounding feedback we get from our longtime listeners. This is one of the kind of meatiest bits that they enjoy the most, is we talk to guests about the path that they followed to get to where they are now. And there's this kind of, assumption that when you become an adult, you just start doing the thing rather than you explore life and the world to do the thing. So can you talk about your first ever job and then your career to date?
Yes, sure. I always was the kind of kid with the lemonade stand. So I was kind of cottoning on to different ways to make cash. But the only place that would employ me when I was young, looking for my very first job, was a pizza delivery company where I took the phones. And it was in the 90s, like mid 90s, I guess, when I was 15. There was no internet maps, no Google Maps, right? So the delivery drivers were constantly getting lost, and there's nothing that quite kind of shapes you for the world of work than taking phones from disgruntled customers waiting for their pizzas and then complaining when their cold pizzas do finally arrive. It was quite a learning curve of customer service and handling myself. It was a franchise, so there was some quite misogynistic practices from this family-owned business, and there was tribes of girls that took the phones and teenage boys that rode the scooters. So it was quite a vibrant place to work. We spent much of my teenage years smelling of onions, which probably wasn't the best start for my foray into adulthood. But there was lots of laughs, looking at each other in the walk-in fridge and things like that, which probably wouldn't have passed the health and safety these days. But yeah, formative years and a lot of fun.
Nice. You said teenage years, so presumably was that prior to college, yes. University?
Yeah, that was like 15, 16, okay. 17. And then I got a job selling coats in Debenhams, which was wonderful because it was Sunday rate and you got a day and a half day rate in those days. So that was a little bit easier and less onion related smells. So that was a good one. And I did the, you know, usual kind of obligatory waiting and table waiting and service jobs.
Okay. So all very frontline.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, my dad lived in Walton-on-the-Naze in Essex. I grew up in Essex and Chelmsford, and my dad lived separately. And I would go and work in a caff, like a really, you know, greasy spoon caff on the weekends. I think I got like £2.40 an hour to clear some tables or something. Maybe that was even before the pizza. That was when I was like 14, yeah.
At that stage, did you have any idea what your career might look like? Did you have any aspirations? And there's no, this isn't a trick question, by the way. Most of the people say no and they kind of discover or still trying to discover that later in life.
I quite early on was quite ambitious. We were quite well off during my kind of junior school, and I went to a private junior school, and then my dad lost his job, my parents separated, and my parents had put two brothers through boarding school and then kind of run out of money. So I was in this situation where I'd gone from relative privilege to free school meals. So that instilled in me a real urge and drive to make my own money. So I actually initially wanted to be a newsreader, but my mum told me that anyone from Essex couldn't be a newsreader. So I kind of parked that and didn't really explore it, but did go on to kind of university and then got swept up into the sort of milk round graduate recruitment schemes. And I definitely had the dollar signs in my eyes and got swept into investment banking. So I was quite motivated for that. In hindsight, not organically for the first result of actually wanting to do the job, but more the secondary result of being quite financially motivated, which, you know, I've pivoted from enormously in terms of my priorities and how I see life. But yeah, I was driven to kind of get ahead and be successful in the business world, whatever that meant. And then after Cambridge, yeah, did go into the world of investment banking as my first proper job.
Okay. I feel like you rather blasé just mentioned after Cambridge.
yeah.
Most people shout quite loudly and proudly about Cambridge.
Yes. I mean, I guess at the time it was like, I always liked smashing the stereotypes of Essex girl and trying to prove myself. But I grew up in a very academic house I was the first one to go to university from this first generation. But, you know, I grew up around playing cards and board games and being quite competitive with two older brothers and having that academic mindset. Both my parents were past the Mensa test. So, yeah, there was that kind of drive to go and make the best of everything. And especially given that kind of financial shock that my family experienced and then really not having that much, I was motivated to go. And someone told me that something called investment banking paid really well, and I just started looking into that, probably for the wrong reasons, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Well, your early career does kind of read like a who's who of investment bankers.
Yeah, I was actually did an internship with Goldman Sachs before university, which was quite rare, where they went to, you know, some schools and recruited some 30 women. Actually, it was a women's only program, and they, you know, bought us leather handbags and took us to the Ivy and put us in a hotel in Fleet Street and then sent us off to our respective top universities to go and shout about Goldman Sachs. It was a very clever marketing ploy at the time. I'm sure they don't quite do it these days, but that was their recruitment tactic. So by the time you're going to Oxbridge and other universities, everyone was buzzing about investment banking or the top law firms or the top consulting firms. And it was very much the thing. And I was, you know, I went with the crowd and actually was motivated for that, but subsequently found that, like, you know, the reality was somewhat different. I actually passed out on the trading floor three times,
which was
quite embarrassing, and was absolutely exhausted from the long hours. And was probably a bit of a square peg in a round hole because I hadn't chosen it for the right reasons. So I, you know, ticked along and I moved sideways trying to explore where my best fit would be, whether it was debt capital markets or trading or prime brokerage, and made a bit of job hopping. And I did okay. But 10 years in, I hit 30 and had what I call my quarter life crisis, where I had a few shocks. My dad died suddenly. My relationship at the time broke down and left me quite brokenhearted, and really started to have quite a major identity reshuffle. And it was at that time that I really started to think about, you know, what career I was in and what was more authentic to me and how I wanted to be. And when I quit, my colleague said to me, if I didn't have you know, three kids in private schools, a mortgage in South Ken, and a wife that shopped in Harrods, I would have quit ages ago. But you almost, people were getting locked into a lifestyle and a way of living. And I just reset and said, what do I want the next 10 years to be? And do I want to be doing this when I'm 40? And what is it that is going to bring me fulfillment and happiness and reward? And I was done with making rich people richer.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. I know it's a ridiculous, for various reasons, metric to use, but passing out three times on the trading floor. Sorry, I don't mean to trivialize that whatsoever, but is that a very real reality of what life is like on the trading floor? Because I've always thought that was just a stereotype, but
I mean, the long hours were super intense, particularly in the, you know, the first years, and some of those stereotypes do play out. I feel a bit out of date now to comment on if that is still the reality, just because we're talking at 2003 was when I started my career. And so that was the reality then. And there was a bravado of, you know, the long hours and, you know, oh, I did a 4 a.m. finish. And it was very macho culture in a sense of having to earn your stripes. But then the rewards would come. And so people knew why they were there, very like financially motivated. You know, and some people thrive in it. You know, if you're really single-minded and you love some of the work, then it can be a really great, rewarding place to be. And I do hope they've improved. But the support was not there for me in terms of elements where I was struggling with sleep deprivation, exhaustion, and just, yeah, some of the culture that went along with it. Other aspects were hugely fun and lots of highs, but lots of lows.
Yeah, the quarter life crisis, as you dubbed it. Is that what triggered you to just reevaluate everything in terms of your professional career? And is that what led to Aces High or the start of that journey?
Right, Aces High was a bit later, but I think absolutely it's the cracks that let the light in, right? And for me, it was, I had kind of ticked along life, you know, quite successfully, ticking a lot of boxes as I went in terms of my aspirations that I set out upon, having the career, the boyfriend, the house, and then at some point reached the end of the rainbow, but the pot of gold wasn't there. You know, I was still unable to scratch the itch, and so really able to reevaluate, oh God, I got this all wrong. I thought if I did X, Y, and Z, then happiness would be forthcoming or fulfillment or whatever it was I was looking for. But with the shocks and so my dad died and then my relationship broke down. And then not long after, I actually lost my best friend and my brother and my mum. That wasn't all exactly the same time, but I think each of those instances really made me stop and think. And particularly when I lost my brother and my best friend, who were more my peers in age, it made me think what a privilege it is to have this life and to go forward, and am I going to waste it? And it really made me reevaluate the people-pleasing element and what I was doing and for whom. So it made me stop and think, who do I care about? Whose opinion, or who am I doing it for? And so I think I was wrapped up as a youngster, I was wrapped up in status and success as a symbol of having made it. And when I was actually able to kind of dig deeper and see, well, what's fulfilling for me? What do I want? What's authentic? And what's going to bring me the most happiness? Yeah, then I was in the wrong place.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I mean, huge kudos to you, because that's wonderful. I'm cheating slightly because I've heard this story before, but at some stage you entered a poker tournament.
Yes, 2016. So we're fast forwarding a little bit. But circling back, as I said, I grew up playing cards, right? Both my parents were at one point or another, as hobbies, bridge teachers, and I would help them prepare the cards for their bridge nights. But I had never picked up a hand of poker until I was 32. And actually, gambling was a dirty word in my house. So my mother's first husband had bet their house on England winning the 1966 World Cup. He quite literally took the deposit for their first home and bet it on England. And so although that paid off financially, she promptly left him, took half the winnings, and went on to meet my dad later, which just meant that growing up, yeah, gambling was not something that was particularly celebrated, quite rightly, in our home. And poker continues to be I guess, the last bastion of male-dominated sports. I think about 11% of FTSE 100 CEOs are women and only 5% of professional poker players. So it took me a while, even with a background in cards, to even pick up poker. And what happened was, it was a boyfriend that was into it and had taught me, and I got to love the game quite quickly. I'd only been learning 6 months, maybe a year, and we were on holiday in Morocco. And on the airport transfer, he'd actually clocked the casino and an advert for an international poker tournament in 2 days' time. And I was actually pregnant in 2016 and not fancying entering this smoky casino for a long poker tournament at all. But he wasn't letting up. And I begrudgingly rolled back on the bus to Agadir and taking my book along, because I was fully expecting an early exit, being somewhat of a more novice learner. So it was not quite like that. I went on, and at 4 a.m, I'd beaten 200 men to win my first international poker tournament. So yeah, that was that story.
Oh, I hope you never tire of that story.
It's
and just to, can you paint a picture of what it was actually like? So here at Gars, we have a client who, I was going to describe him as a pro, but he's not a pro because he does it on the side, but he earns a significant amount of his income through playing poker tournaments. And some of the stories he tells me about where they play and the context of where they're playing is very different to what you might see in the movies. What was this like?
So the one in Agadir was a very smoky casino. I remember it being, and it was all men and just tables and tables of people, like a sea of people. And it goes on for hours. I think people don't always realize how time consuming poker is, because particularly when it's a tournament, because it's a knockout tournament, right? So what has to happen is that you have to, at some point, your chip stack whittles down and you go all in and you wait for people to be knocked out before the top table can finish with the tournament. So it was literally 4 a.m. as the sun was coming up, and I walked out of the casino with wads of dirham, like so much cash. They didn't do anything electronically. And my boyfriend was just like, just get in the taxi and just don't make eye contact. It was a little bit like, let's just get home and get all these wads of cash. And then there was some photos we took of me doing that kind of cringy thing of throwing it up in the air and on the bed when we got back to the hotel.
Oh, I hope so. That's incredible. So you say it took several hours. I assume it's what, best part of 10, 12 hours?
It's like 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a decent sprint.
Yeah, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You do have to, I mean, we talk in Aces High in our workshops, not just about decision-making and negotiation, but also self-regulation under pressure. And that's your fight or flight response in the moments of stress. But it's also just physically, you need to make sure you're hydrated. Have you used the bathroom? Have you eaten? What your blood sugar level's doing? Anything that can put you in the best possible position for your decision making. I think, yeah, it's a long stint.
Mental stamina, I imagine.
Absolutely. And not going on tilt after one bad beat, right? So if you lose a hand where you feel statistically you were on it to win, but there was an unlucky turn of the cards, how do you reset after that? And it's very common to, it's known as going on tilt, to then play badly, not just in that one hand that went wrong, but then to continue. So I think recognizing self-awareness and recognizing that is part of the challenge.
You said you were the only woman who entered the tournament. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
I think maybe to do with the culture as well, right? So typically, even in the UK, when I enter tournaments, you'd think it would be, I don't know, 60-40 or 70-30. It really still isn't. It's much more like 90-10 or 95-5 for the sort of levels that I'm playing. For the more advanced ones, yeah, maybe you're going to see more women, but it still continues to be hugely male-dominated.
Yeah. And when I heard you talk recently, there was a line you said which just stuck in my brain, which was, poker is a game played by men made for women.
Absolutely, yes.
Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, I think the stereotype of poker needs to be unpacked first, that it's a game of bluff and bravado and bullying. And obviously, you know, if you grew up in the UK like me, you're going to be familiar with the big poker scenes in, you know, Lockstock and Ocean's 11 and Only Fools and Horses. And in every single one, it's groups of gangsters around in a smoky basement playing this game of bluff and bravado called five-card draw. But actually, the game I'm referring to that's most commonly played is Texas Hold'em. And it differs from five card draw, where five of your cards are private. But in Texas Hold'em, you only have two private cards and up to five face-up community cards. And so most of the information about the hand is public, which makes it much less a game of bluff and much more a game of strategy and statistics and skill. So whilst there's the perception that it's a game of bluff and bravado, it's actually a game of deep listening, reading the room, knowing your value and being able to assertively communicate that. And so the listening and the body language and the empathy that you have in order to not just play your cards, but imagine what cards they have and then imagine what cards they think you have, I think really lends itself to some of the more feminine traits. So I don't think it needs to be overly gendered, but because the stereotypes don't always represent the reality of Texas Hold'em poker, culturally and historically, it's a game that men dominate and have played more frequently. People, particularly women, think maybe it's not a game for them. But actually, I see beginner women at the Aces High events and are able to listen, are able to empathize. And when they're able to assert their hands and their value, do so brilliantly. And I think it should be a game that's open to everyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should have fact checked the actual stats around her, but Victoria Corrin Mitchell's had, you know, huge success, right, in poker. Was she a former or current world champion?
Yeah, she's phenomenal. She's won the European and I think she got the World Series of Poker bracelet as well. So I think she's phenomenal. I'm one of my heroes in the world of poker. But I'd challenge you to name another female poker player.
No, I'd come up short, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Not well represented. She's the one that comes up time and again, and we're delighted that she can like fly that flag and show that it's, you know, a game of intellect and that anyone can pull up a seat at the table. But this is why we draw parallels between the poker table and the boardroom table, both spaces that historically have been male dominated, but both now need to kind of invite more women and more diversity into it. And I think pulling up a seat at the table and kind of having the confidence and self-belief that this is a space that you can thrive in is part of the challenge.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that stat you mentioned earlier. I think you said around 11%, was it 11% of CEOs? I remember one of our early episodes of Call to Action was with the wonderful Dr. Stephanie Johnson, and the stat she shared, and I'm going to get the name wrong, and it's probably out of date now, so this is stupid me even saying it, but I think at the time there were more CEOs in America called John or some other.
Yes, I've heard that one.
There were women CEOs. So, and obviously it's reflected in the poker tables. So those parallels with the boardroom and then business, did you see that link as you began to play more poker, or was that evident all along? Like, so in your investment banking days, did you see the kind of, I don't know, the way that ego played out, the way that empathy played out, the way that, you know, there was that kind of macho persona just so evident? Did you see the parallels between that and poker and the kind of gaming side of things?
So I think I've always believed that there's different styles of leadership that are equally valid, right? It's not just the domineering or the stereotypically alpha or male leadership style. And I definitely saw that in banking and how at the time, a lot of the women that were getting ahead were trying to emulate masculine leadership traits, but that there was a space for more feminine leadership traits that, you know, could be as effective, if not more effective. I wasn't drawing any parallels in poker at that time. I hadn't learned poker. And it was only later when I did start to play more regularly and really get into it that I saw it benefiting my own career. I saw in my tech startup where I was able to raise investment capital from venture capital firms and from angel investors, I had to hold my own in negotiations, and I directly drew from holding my own at the poker table and some of the learnings that I had got from, you know, just when to lean in, what part of myself to bring. You know, in poker, there's a concept of a table persona, which is how you're perceived when you first sit down at the table, and other players may start to categorize you. And you can even consciously manage your table persona. You might adopt a guise of either quite weak and flighty, only to strengthen up at a certain time, or you might want to appear very dominant. You know, if I'm at a casino, I might act like it's my first time there, or people assume I'm just there with the boyfriend and I let them believe it. And then I maybe even play a few hands loosely and sacrifice some chips early on. Those first impressions stick, and then I can tighten up. and take their money. And that's what I wanted to more consciously do in business was, okay, what executive presence, what table persona am I bringing? How is my self-belief and my value being asserted here? And what are their needs? And what do I imagine, what cards do I imagine they hold? And so that empathy and that negotiation was really able to help me in business. But how it was born and how it really, like that light bulb moment, was less about myself, although I had seen it. I've hosted my own home games for a number of years now, and they were always male dominated. And so I wanted more women coming to my home games, and had some brilliant women in my network that I started to teach beginners poker to. And through those weekly sessions, quite organically, they were coming back with various anecdotes about how they were better able to assert themselves. They were closing client deals, landing promotions, asserting boundaries in their home life. And actually, my friend Caroline said to me after a salary negotiation, she said, I realized I had aces and there was no way I was folding. So time and again, people were drawing parallels from the poker table. And that's really when I realized there's something in this. There is skills that we're developing and building through poker as a prism, as a lens to self-reflect and then more consciously dial those up when it serves us in the other areas of our life. Time, weather, and
we interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on building a funnel. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
I mentioned in the introduction, I kind of elaborated slightly on the skills that you teach or come across through your workshops, including negotiation, assertiveness, risk management, empathy. Are there any kind of core skills that it tends to build more than others?
I think the ones we really look at are sort of the negotiation piece and reframing negotiation. I think a lot of people stereotype negotiation as I win, you lose, and that's the best outcome. Where in most instances in the workplace, negotiations are less about winning and losing and more about people coming together with incomplete information, maybe even on the same team, right? Work colleagues that you're having a clash with, you actually have shared objectives of making the deal work or whatever it is, but you have different information and you're coming at it. And so how can you negotiate, contribute and assert the information or the knowledge or the experience you have and empathize and listen to the experience they have in order to have a conversation about what the best path forward could be. And so I think that's where the teams we work with have quite a lot of aha moments about how listening and poker can actually be really helpful for collaboration and teamwork as part of that negotiation.
Yeah. And how important is a poker face? And the reason I ask that is because you said something a few minutes ago, which I really enjoyed, was I almost felt like you played the fact that people assumed, I'm assuming you were talking about the tournament in Mexico, you almost played to your advantage the fact that people assumed you were just there with your boyfriend. So
oh,
in
yes.
effect, does that make you a hustler?
I still do that now. No, that wasn't. Okay. But yeah, no, I think it's about understanding how people perceive you and then sometimes using that to your advantage, even if it could be potentially as the underdog. So yeah, definitely letting them believe a weakness only to tighten up when they don't expect it. And I think what really plays into the male-female dynamic at the poker table is ego. And I don't want to stereotype, but men do hate losing to girls in my experience at the poker table. And what that means is they bet more aggressively to you. And so when you do have strong cards or you feel you can outplay them, there's just more money to be taken. So I do quite enjoy that aspect.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Funnily enough, I play a lot of football and one of my best friends, Kate, is a professional football player. She represents the two different Lionesses teams and she regularly comes and plays football with me and it's a group of guys and she's the only woman. She runs rings around most of them and it's the most enjoyable thing ever, Joe.
I'm
just
imagine.
Seeing how upset some of the guys are afterwards just kind of makes my evening. You talk about the power of pause in communications. Is that something that is part of poker or is that more of a case of holding your own and challenging people's perceptions of you? Because I can understand it from a negotiation perspective.
Yeah, I think it's in poker as well. And I think it's for me personally. So I definitely have a habit of coming out fighting. I'm quite alpha. If I'm backed into a corner, you know, my default can not always serve me. And I think recognizing where our default behaviors are springing into action and knowing that that's not the only option available to us. So I think, yeah, no, a great poker player can really make you doubt yourself without saying a word, and they do let the silence stretch. And sometimes there's time limits, but they manage somehow to kind of command the space and slow the conversation. I think that parallels from poker into business as well. But I think pausing can be a few different things. It can be a negotiation, but it can also be in that fight or flight response. And so at the poker table, when all eyes are on you, nothing can happen until you act, there's absolutely a massive adrenaline response. And if you're knee-jerking in poker or in business, the chances are it's not a well-considered thought out. And so if you are able to reset a little bit and find some space, whether that's time or breath or even walking away from the poker table and coming back at various times to kind of manage that stress response. I taught Claire just the other week, a beginner, and she was dealt a pair of aces, which is pocket rockets, the single best starting hand in poker. And there was a raise and a re-raise before her. And she absolutely panicked and was unable to engage in the negotiation to such an extent that she just folded, and she preferred to walk away from victory than fight for it. And in that moment, she was the flight in the fight, flight or freeze. She just couldn't engage. And so that's an extreme example. For me, it would be more likely to come out fighting, but sometimes that doesn't serve me when I shovel in with a weak hand, not because it's the right move, but because I'm trying to take control. And so how can you just pause to recognize what is my default, what is actually the situation calling for, and make sure you're not in your kind of amygdala fight or flight brain, but using the part of your brain, your prefrontal cortex, that is responsible for the reason and the logic and the decision making. And so having some tools in your arsenal to reset and manage the stress response and pausing is a great one, I think, can be super helpful.
That's amazing. What would you have done in that instance if you had a pair of pocket rockets?
I would have slow played them.
Okay, yeah, I was
so
going to say.
I would have called. If there's a raise and a re-raise before me, I'd call that. You might also choose to raise on top because then you get to build the pot, but then you're showing the strength of your hand. So I would see the flop calling and then bet aggressively on the flop or see what came down, if there was any scare cards. Yeah.
Amazing. The reason this bit really stood out for me in our research, the power of the pause, I think pausing is so important in all sorts of different walks of life. I've heard there's a great pricing expert called Blair Renz talks about pricing, but there was a story lodged in my brain somewhere, a Churchill story. So I went looking for it the other day. It's something I must have read in like 2008, and it just... I'm going to read a little passage of it out because it's fascinating. It was in 19... This is from Churchill's memoirs, by the way. It was in 1940 during the Second World War. France was about to fall to the Germans and Neville Chamberlain was about to resign as Prime Minister of Great Britain. He called Winston Churchill and Lord Halifax into his office. He said, "Well, one of you two will have to replace me. Who's it going to be?" Churchill wrote in his memoirs, "I knew no Englishman could ever say, 'Give it to me.' So whoever spoke first would be the loser. It was the longest 30 seconds of my life, but nothing would induce me to speak. Eventually, Halifax couldn't bear it any longer. He cracked. He said, 'Well, I suppose you better give it to Winston.'" Which is just such a lovely story. Nice. But I think that power of the pause is just such a real thing. But obviously, yeah, a slightly different context.
I love that.
Do you find when you run your workshops, I'd love to be in one, and actually I think that that's likely to happen soon, I hope. Is it obvious to you the kind of hierarchy within a business by the way that people typically start to show up or immediately show up at the table? What I mean is it obvious to see who the boss is in the room? Is it obvious to see who the kind of, I don't know, lesser experienced members of the team might be by just the way they hold themselves?
Not necessarily seniority, but personality. Okay. Absolutely. Fine. Personality, time and again, like cookie cutter. And what people are taking away is these aha moments of like, oh my God, I didn't realize, but I do this all the time. I for example, am incapable of making a decision until I have all the information, and it slows me up and it means that I miss out on opportunities because I'm awaiting perfect information. And so through poker, we're able to say, well, this is, you're going to have to make decisions with imperfect information, but it's a mirror. And so you do see, you know, the very analytical types, and you could guess that they're in the research department, and you do see the more alpha males, and you could probably make a guess they're in sales or they're going to be in management. And so, yes, absolutely. And we had a lawyer the other day that just was analyzing everything. But some of the lawyers are good at negotiating as well. So it can go either way. Less the job, but definitely the personality. And that is the power of the microcosm we're presenting, the mirror we're holding up, so people can better understand. It's an immersive experiential where it's complete beginners, completely beginner friendly, and zero gambling. So totally sanitized poker for the corporate environment, and really just using it as a lens to show people and teams how they can communicate better, assert themselves and perform under pressure. So it's really powerful. It's brilliant.
And it's not only, obviously your workshops are tailored for businesses, but I also understand you're teaching your son to play poker.
Yes, that's right. Much like my parents would try and teach me bridge, and I was probably not that interested initially. I'm now getting him to learn poker. He's much more interested in the snacks and the pizzas at our poker nights than the actual cards. And I do wonder if it's that element of, you know, what your parents want you to do, you're kind of not interested in. So we'll see if it sticks.
Totally.
And I don't think poker has to include significant gambling. It can be matchsticks. It can just be chips. But what I want him to learn is the resilience it teaches, because with every hand, A, you have the kind of opportunity to start fresh the next time, and it can make you reflect on your losses and how you played and, you know, the size of your bets and the statistics in there. So I do think there's a lot of really beneficial skills for everyone.
Yeah, amazing. I've two daughters. My eldest, she's only 9. We started playing Cheat, which was one of my favorite card games growing up, and she must have a tell, but I just can't find what it is. And I'm so proud and fascinated when I play with her when she does one over me. Just quickly on the workshops without the, like, does removing the gambling element, does that change anything, do you think? Like, psychologically, does it therefore mean less, so people are slightly more reckless? Or, as I probably think is most likely, does even having chips become, you know, the kind of monetary value of sorts, and people take it just as seriously?
Yes, exactly. So we're still moving chips around, and we do have a gamification element where we've got prizes for the winner. So it's champagne trophies and chocolates for the runner up. And so you do see everyone taking it as seriously and really wanting to win and not wanting to sacrifice their chips. And it's really interesting to see the personalities that are able to kind of assert themselves and those that hang back. So I don't think it matters at all, but you do need the chips. You do need a stake. Otherwise, there's no kind of rounds of betting and nothing that you're sacrificing. But you would be amazed at the kind of competitive elements that come out. And it's quite fun. And the energy levels by the end are super high. We sort of run over a 3 to 4 hour workshop, and people really want that trophy.
Yeah, no, I believe you. We just took the team go-karting, and it was very, very serious. Amazing. I've got a couple of listener questions I was going to move to now, Jo.
Lovely.
So, asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. We've got two. I'm going to start with Katie. Katie says, poker tables are a bit like boardroom tables in as much as there's too many blokes bluffing. How do we get more women around poker and boardroom tables? We've kind of touched on that, but...
Yeah, I know. I love it. I mean, it's what I live for, right? I've always been a woman in a man's world, from growing up with two older brothers and male cousins, to Cambridge, to investment banking, to tech startups, to poker. So quite literally, always kind of trying to fly the flag for underrepresented women or other minorities. How do we do it? I think it's about smashing the stereotypes. And that's part of the reason why Aces High exists, particularly with a female lead, to show you that actually it's not bluff and bravado and boys' night. It's strategy, you know, teamwork, empathy, all of these skills that might lend themselves to women. So I hope Aces High is doing a small bit to help that. I don't want to, you know, encourage all different types of people into gambling. We're actually very much distance ourselves from that. But the boardroom table, I mean, it's a huge question. It's got to have relatable role models, It's got to have people smashing the glass ceiling. And we need men. We need allies that are kind of not just the women making those moves, but saying, actually, when we have diversity in the boardroom, everyone benefits. I think we're seeing that more and more. Most people are kind of on board with this now. We just need to see money where the mouth is in terms of equal pay, parental leave, equal parental leave, shared parental leave for men to make sure they can take the kind of the mental load in the domestic life and the home life. And I think that all is moving and making great strides. So I'm optimistic, and I see my son's 8 and I see the generation of young girls and women coming through, and I'm really optimistic for them. I think in one generation, most of the world's global leaders will be women, maybe naively, but I believe that.
I think there's a lot to be encouraged about. Our previous episode was with Karen Dobray, and she was the director from Lewis Football Club, who brought in equal pay for their football team and kind of altered the terraces to suit the women's game more.
I listened to that one. It was brilliant.
I did. Yeah. Karen's wonderful. Yeah. She's great. So yeah, no, I'm similarly as enthusiastic as you are. And I hope I hope your prediction is right. James asks, what's one subtle tell you've learned to identify in individuals that often indicates a strong potential for leadership, even if they don't see it in themselves?
A tell for leadership. I was going to the poker table and thinking a tell for bluffing. Okay, a tell for leadership. I think humility. I think if you are actually, you know, able to understand your skills, but kind of not necessarily need to be leader of the pack and have that leadership style that brings everyone forward together or leads from behind almost. I think that's a brilliant one. And sometimes we're in a world where we celebrate extroverts and there's more introverted or diverse styles of leadership. So I think someone that's pushing someone else forward, whether that's a peer or someone beneath them or whatever, but anyone that's championing someone else in a supportive and meaningful way, normally is going to be a great leader. So someone that's not shouting about their own skills and assets, but celebrating others, I think is a really good tell for a brilliant leader.
Yeah, amazing. I now need to know what the tell for bluffing answer is.
Well, it's tricky because you know someone's having a stress response, but you might not know if that's because they have a very strong hand and they're triggered by it, or if they are bluffing. But breath hold is a very common one, or different changes in breathing. And it's about identifying patterns more than a one-off thing. It's not that I saw them, I don't know, look up and left, that means X. It's much more their pattern has been to not hold their cards, and now they're covering their two cards at the table, they've got something tied. So it's about, you know, the breaks in patterns more than one thing I can tell you.
So you're kind of desperately trying to benchmark everyone's behavior at the start to see what
a little bit, but I would caution with that. It is definitely, you know, the sort of brilliant basics are your statistics and your strategy and your, you know, starting hands and all of the reliable poker strategy. And then once you've established that, maybe you can layer on some intuition and some tells, but I wouldn't promote that as a strategy in itself.
No. Okay. Amazing. The final part then, Joe, is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. Number one being, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I think just care. I mean, it's probably a cliched one, but care less what people think. You know, I think also you're rich if you have all the money and you would still do what you're doing and not mistake, you know, wealth for monetary wealth, but wealth for, you know, how you spend your time. If you had all the money in the world and all the time in the world, how would you spend your days? And if that answer is what you're doing now, then you're absolutely rich. And I think that I can hand on heart say that's true for me with ACSI. Sharing poker and bringing those parallels to the workplace is so much fun for me, so much fun for the participants. I would do that all day long. And not having, you know, having got sucked into the world of investment banking that was never going to be right for me personally, I think, reevaluating what wealth is and caring less what people think.
Yeah, that's amazing advice. Brilliant. Number two, if you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why? And I guess in this instance, the industry could just be the business world, I suppose.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's quite the poker industry, the events industry, or kind of the corporate space. Definitely if it was the poker industry, I would say, or like gambling industry, I would say slot machines. They, you know, are a horrible, poisonous funnel to get sucked into. And I, despite, you know, spending a lot of time in the poker world, I really caution against gambling and anything. It's quite pernicious, and the way they market it is got a lot to be up for as well. But banished that, I think, slot machines.
Yeah, amazing. Are there any books that you would recommend to our listeners? These can but don't need to be, you know, poker or business related.
Well, I think neatly there's one that straddles the two, which is Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, who's an American professional poker player. And it gets super interesting about the bit I loved about it is where she starts to disaggregate a decision from an outcome. And I think very commonly we conflate those two things. So you can make a good decision and it not play out the way you wanted, but it doesn't mean the decision was wrong. And likewise, you could win or have a good outcome, but actually the decision was flawed. And by disaggregating those two things, I think you're better able to assess, you know, your right strategy for life, strategy at the poker table, and also how you're able to make decisions with incomplete information. So I think there's a lot there that echoes some of the things we're trying to bring to life with Aces High. So that's a brilliant book.
And again, amazingly, that's not come up before, Thinking in Bets. I'm familiar with the book actually, but yeah, it's not come up before, which is increasingly rare.
Okay, good.
Fantastic. And then number four, we always dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest and ask they give their reason why. Would you
lovely.
Dedicate
if
the episode?
If it's not too cliched, I'd like to give it to a family member, which is my brother, Adam, living. He died at 38 from cancer. He was an absolute free thinker and he was staunchly against any kind of like status quo or, you know, had a bit of a problem with like, you know, people in charge and was living in Ecuador in a very free spirited way. And he's inspired me to kind of really live authentically, I guess, take every opportunity. When I lost, you know, numerous people in my life, I realized I had no fucks left to give. Like, I'm doing me and I'm stopped people pleasing or trying to be something. And he was like absolutely the best at that. So
amazing.
My brother Adam.
Oh, that's an incredible dedication. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Adam Living.
Thank you, that's a lot.
As a final call to action, then, everyone listening can find links to Aces High, to Thinking in Bets, to everything we've shared in the last 45, 50 minutes. How else can our listeners get more Joe?
Feel free to reach out. I'm on LinkedIn and we have aceshighlondon.com and Instagram is @aceshighlondon. So you're going to have some reels from our events and various bits and bobs on the website. So yeah, come and give a Aces High corporate team building workshop a go and I think you'll all love it. So that would be great.
Amazing. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Joe. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege to talk.
Thank you so much for having me. What a joy.
And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the podcast. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online, or you can email The Mouthful, that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
To action, I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try and I try.